I remember some beautiful advice Chuck Berry gave the band in San Francisco in the early 60s when everything was starting to go and the big contracts were coming in. I was doing some lyric writing at that time, Steve Miller Band and various other groups, and Mr. Berry in the kitchen said, apropos making hit records and hit tunes and getting an audience behind you, he said, the trouble with you white boys is that you try to play every note. He said, man, if that audience is with you, they're going to follow you. Just hit enough of them so they can follow you. Well, that's what's going on here. I trust that you're all black enough to fill in what you don't hear on every moment. All right? Is that too Hollywood?
That's cool, man.
That's Hollywood Boulevard. My first parish in this town was Hollywood Boulevard. I'm bringing us to a couple of paragraphs, and I use these books so that you can see for yourself that this is not speculation just from me. It's like a lawyer presenting the evidence and says to you, look around you, the evidence is overwhelming. But for this case today, I'm only bringing a couple of paragraphs, which are just a few excerpts out of a few books out of some 20,000 volumes, which could be brought at any moment, out of a possible several million volumes that do exist, to, by implication, show you that if you look into this yourself, there's no end to what you can find. This book is called Masks, Transformation, and Paradox, and it's about ancient Greek drama and culture, society, published by the University of California Press, published in 1986. Here, in a section towards the end, it's a chapter 5, entitled The Third Eye. The Third Eye. And we'll just come to the end of it. While we saw that the Naman, N-A-M-A-N, the Naman, as the sign of the third eye, achieved in India, archetypal status equal to the images of lions and of sacred vessels and themes of divine union, hieros gamos. It is not yet clear what kind of meaning the marking of the forehead between the eyes of gorgons might have had for the Greeks. In India, there's the opening of the third eye, and one puts a jewel here. In the Greek tradition, the gorgon has a mark of the third eye there. Do you not know who the Gorgon was? It's time to find out. In our psyches, all of this is devastatingly real. And if you go with smiling naivete to open your third eye, you're going to look at the Gorgon in a primordial way. The classic caution is, be circumspect, friend. The classic formulation, which was written over the gate of going into the underworld, is, abandon all hope, ye who enter here. The hope for enlightenment will keep you in ignorance for eternity. The first thing you have to give up is the hope for enlightenment. It's not something that you can hope for. That indeed is a mythic image. Notice that when you put the Greek and the Indian together, when you put this together, you get a very, very sophisticated montage. But it isn't just the Greek and the Indian that make this. Any of the sibling civilizations produce the same in-depth spherical differential capacity. In Alexandria, it was the Greek and the Egyptian. But it was so difficult in Alexandria that neither the Greeks nor the Egyptians were able to see it, even though they were of it. The Jews were the first to see it in Alexandria, because they were able to be both Greek or Egyptian, but really neither. And they had the stereoptic vision. They saw, oh. It's neither this nor that. Neti. It's something other. It's something beyond this tension. This polarity does indeed create this tension, and the lines of force between that tension are psychically real, and the figures that are made out of those lines of tension are psychic images which are just as real as your psyche. But if you take away that tension, that polarity, not only do the lines of force disappear, but the psychic images that are made in those lines of force and of those lines of force also disappear. Like that. It's not a slow disenchantment, it's a gone. Now, you may not be able to sustain it very long at first, but the glimpse, the insight, is that they are not there. The mind is empty of that furniture, even for a split second. Even for a split second, you have fresh air. And with practice, that split second can be extended enough so that it becomes even socially conscious. The pencil doesn't want to be a part of it. Throw the pencil away. I'm expressing to you something here which is radically important, not because it comes from me. I was given this by my teachers, given to you as your companion. Let's go to this. While we saw that the Naman, as a sign of the third eye, achieved in India archetypal status equal to the images of lions and of sacred vessels and themes of divine union, it is not yet clear what kind of meaning the marking of the forehead between the eyes of Gorgons might have had for Greeks. That is, by 1986, it still wasn't clear. We're on the cutting edge. Today, here, we're on the cutting edge of pioneering. What does this mean? He writes, curious though it may be that each and every kind of Gorgon mark can be readily explained in Indian terms, we do not have explanations from Greece that are in any way as exact as those we have from Indian iconography. But this is not to say that there is no Greek evidence to be had. There are descriptions of Gorgons that have, like the gray eye, G-R-A-I-A-E, the gray eye, the three graces, the three sisters of fate, who as an ensemble are the gray eye. They have a removable eye in their foreheads, but the gray eye as an ensemble have one removable eye in between them. Now in the Protean mythological symbolism of Botticelli, in the Primavera, the three graces are three beautiful gals, each having two eyes, as beautiful gals should have. But behind Botticelli's mythologies is the ritual bare attention reality that the three graces have but one eye, which they have to pass among them and put in the forehead. One learns a great respect for life when you begin to realize how precarious it all is. It is all very precarious. There are descriptions of Gorgons that have, like the gray eye, a removable eye in their foreheads, and of the Medusa,
who has but one stony eye that is petrifying, to say nothing of the reoccurring theme of petrifaction, turning to stone.
Notice here that whenever you see the Gorgon's head, you think you see that the Gorgon, she has two eyes. It's not so. The terrific realization is that the Gorgon is cross-eyed and has but one focus of vision. And it's a focus of vision that the rest of that face are the fangs and the tongue out in madness and this hair of wild snakes. It's an esoteric realization. Has but one stony eye whose glance is petrifying. The way that the eye sees is what it makes happen. Notice the high magic here. A stony eye, whatever a stony eye sees, turns to stone. Why? Because it has that symbolic power, the magic psyche of the supranatural level operating. How is the Gorgon Medusa handled? Who handles the Gorgon Medusa? In the Greek iconography, in the Greek mythic image, it is Perseus. It is Perseus who uses a mirror. The precise formulation of it is that he uses his own shield as a mirror to cut off her head. Cannot look. He uses his own shield, uses his own psychic defense as a mirror within which to see the reverse of the image. Notice that the stony look, the magic eye, does not survive a reflection. It doesn't survive a reflection off the shield, off the mirror. It does not survive the reflection in memory. The best shield is memory. It doesn't matter how courageous a warrior you are, if you're holding a shield other than memory, you're done. The shield of memory that allows for reflection saps the evil of its capacity to continue. It's like lightning is grounded in the earth. The psychic energy is grounded in the reflection. It's a very, very important point. It's colloquial. Dracula looks into a mirror and there's nothing there. But what's further, if Dracula continues to look in the mirror, he will not be there. He shies away from that. The person whose eyes mirror the evil looking at it dispels it. This is why someone who is deeply troubled will not look into your eyes. Your eyes for the moment become the shield wherein the Gorgon and them will be short-circuited, snuffed out, look away or flinch. It isn't just sight, it's in any aspect of the hearing. One mishears what is said to one, or one doesn't want to hear it. Or one doesn't show up for a class because you're afraid that if I do, there are all sorts of ways in which this happens. All kinds of ways in which this happens. So here we are. There are descriptions of Gorgons that have, like the gray eye, a removable eye on their foreheads, and of the Medusa who has but one stony eye that is petrifying, to say nothing of the reoccurring theme of petrifaction. It seems, in other words, that the idea of a mental power that functions as an externalized force
an insight that is also all-seeing, is so like the Naman, the third eye, the Tilaka, as to necessitate a structural comparison of the Indian notion with the Perseus Gorgon legend. And doing so provides some interesting results. In Sanskrit, the word Naman means not only a characteristic mark or sign, but also name. The Naman is not only the mark on the forehead, but is really the name. It's Naman in Sanskrit, it's Nama in Persian, the ancient Persian. But Nama in ancient Persian carries not only the sense of name, but carries the sense of royal name. So that in Persian, the word Nama tends to mean king, or Nama. Like the classic national epic of Persia is the Shahnameh, and it has to do with the formation of kings, the name of the kings, the book of the name of the kings. It's associated like that. So that royal self, your real name, is symbolically you. In Sanskrit, the word Naman means not only a characteristic mark or sign, but also name. Name, renown, fame. To give a name, the Naman, in other words, is the mark that establishes identity. The Sanskrit cognate of our word, name. Notice that in Sanskrit it's Naman and in English it's name. Notice how close they are. Notice again, our languages are cognate. We tend to think of Sanskrit as a language of India way back when. It's a contemporaneous psychological happening in a sibling way. India is not our opposite way back when. It's our contemporary right here. It's in the same family. The creative tension, the creative opposite, is in a different mode with China, China, Japan, East Asia. That's the creative opposition. That is to say, the lines of tension between Greek and Egyptian, or between Roman and Indian, or between Celt and Jew, those lines of tension are not creative tensions in the sense of confrontations with the other. They're in fact just working out relationships in the larger civilized amplitudes of our own self. Those relationships belong in the development of the internalization of the self. They belong in self-development, but in the first year of our program. What belongs in the second year to make consciousness happen is not those relationships, but the creative tension of dealing with the other. And the focus in the second year here is to understand progressively that one has to learn to turn around within oneself and address one's otherness, personified in cultural terms, East meets West, but in a real East meets West way. Now, what is peculiar in this for Americans, North and South Americans, but particularly North Americans, is that the American Indians belong to the East Asian culture. American Indians are Taoists, in a way, natural Taoists. So that there are very peculiar circumstances and situations in the United States in its beginnings. In its 17th century beginnings, the experience was with the real creative tension between self and other. The largely European or African populations that came here vis-a-vis the American Indians had an incredible encounter that just now is being made conscious. East
meets West on the altar of the American Indian in our history, in our understanding. This was not always understood. It was not always seen. Again, the first person to understand this actual fact was Thoreau. Thoreau was the first person to be self-conscious enough and educated enough and developed enough to be able to understand this is what's happening. The making of the cabin at Walden is his version of the American Indian Vision Quest. It's a prototype of what we're subjected to by circumstance and necessity in the late 20th century and larger issues. Now, Emerson, for instance, never understood that. Brilliant as he was, he never had the creative encounter with the American Indian that Thoreau did. There's a world of difference, a vast gulf between Thoreau and Emerson. Emerson is a learned, cultivated European on American soil, and Thoreau is a new man, a kind of man who had never been seen before. He's a pioneer of a new kind of humanity, that American who has finally been transformed by the Indian. Now, another person who saw this but did not live it, saw it and understood it but did not live it, was James Fenimore Cooper. And his protagonist in the Leather Stocking saga is the man who has undergone this transformation. Cooper understood it symbolically. He internalized the material accurately. He symbolically understood what an American Indian, a white Indian, would be. And what is his life cycle? And at every juncture in his life cycle, he changes his name. He's Deerslayer, or he's Pathfinder, or he's Hawkeye. And finally, at the end, he's the old trapper. He doesn't have any name anymore. He's not nameless in the sense of a loss, but he's nameless because he has matured to become whatever function he's doing. And when he dies out in the prairie, the Indians who have killed him understand that some great spirit is passing, and they stop the animosity and realize that one of their own has died. He wasn't white at all. And he wasn't quite Indian. He was some new kind of a man. Cooper understood it symbolically. Thoreau lived it artistically. And one of Thoreau's great occupations was to try to find a new language to talk about the new kind of man which he had become. And towards the end of his life, because he didn't live very long, he only lived to be about 43, 44 years old, he passed the vision on to one other person. Only one person understood what Thoreau was talking about, and that was the young Walt Whitman. And in a conversation in a New York hotel room that went on for hours and hours, Whitman listened to Thoreau and realized that what he was doing in writing Leaves of Grass was provincially limited by his self-conception, and that when he accepted the creative encounter, he turned Leaves of Grass into a quest for a cosmic person. Do I contradict myself? Very well, then I contradict myself. That kind of a thing. And if you look at the first edition of Leaves of Grass before he met Thoreau and had that conversation, and compare it with the Leaves of Grass that finally came out, there's not only a radical difference in size, 100 times almost as much, but the whole tone is transformed. And Whitman did his best to broadcast with his barbaric yap the message to the world. The message is, it isn't just an American experience, it's a worldwide experience of a new humanity that's coming in one by one. And every individual who comes in has to initiate themselves. It's a self-selected initiation to be able to live in the new world. Not to adjust to the sociological world that seems to be in power. That sociological world that seems to be in power has about 10 more years to go and it is gone. Like last season's dandelions. None of it is going to stay. And it's not a matter of tears and fearfulness. It's the way things are. The handwriting on the wall, as the book of Daniel says. It's the handwriting on the wall. The Naman, in other words, is the mark that establishes identity. The Sanskrit cognate of our word name. While recalling the correspondence between names beginning with per and the underworld suggests one interesting parallel between Perseus and the Gorgon. Considering the etymological connection between Perseus and person, one has the sense that the myth is more archetypal still. In other words, if you settle for just intellectually understanding Perseus and the Gorgon as mythic images in a mythological prototype, you still miss the existential, radical, transformative experience that is there. It's deeper than the feeling-toned expectation is. It's deeper than the thinking-toned projection is. There is a symbolic realization at the core of one's own being that is possible. It is that that must be had. Not had to stuff in your pocket, but to commit oneself to. There are moments of growth where one has to take the step into the unknown, 100%. Then in all hope ye who enter here. Notice you don't abandon the quest. You just abandon the baggage and luggage of hopes and expectations so that you can do and be what is there, whatever that is. So here, considering the etymological connection between Perseus and person, one has the sense that the myth is more archetypal still. Looking in the divine mirror, the divine mirror, notice now the stakes are raised. Not your mirror, God's mirror. University of California Press book. I'm telling you, things are far along. They're leaving the 19th century occult scene behind so far that it is another age, a different age entirely. Looking in the divine mirror, what kind of demon does the hero overcome? Whose identity does this person see? And he ends the chapter with that. Those are really questions. Now, if you were here Tuesday night for the Hermetic Wisdom Liturgy, the community prayer that was offered up was from 2,000 years ago, one of the Odes of Solomon, the 13th Ode of Solomon. And in there was perfectly expressed in a quiet hymn of about 7 lines, the experience of looking in the divine mirror under Protean circumstances. I won't disappoint you by giving you the verse now. You can look it up on your own. That's what's happening here. Now, I'm going to have to put off until next week, but I want you to understand that the Shiva-Dionysius connection goes back some 4,000 years ago. In other words, the Shiva-Dionysius connection is not characteristic of the Hellenistic world 2,000 years ago. It's not that Shiva and Dionysius, but of the previous cycle 2,000 years ago from that. Notice that the Shiva and Dionysius is like a grandparent situation to our condition. It's not a parental model against which to fight. It's a grandparent situation from which to learn. My friend Sydney tells me that nobody else is talking this way. I hope somebody else is talking this way. Let's come back next week. Bring your paintings.
I had at least one painting today.
All right, let's have a painting. Let's do the painting. I'm through.
I'm not going to be here for 2 weeks, so I would like to share mine.
All right, let's show some paintings. Let's have these paintings.